to our panel on the future of spectrum policy. As the FCC's national broadband plan found, mobile broadcast represents the convergence of the last two great disruptive technologies, internet computing and mobile communications, and may be more transformative than either of these previous breakthroughs. Spectrum is also critical to numerous federal, state, and local government operations, from national security and aviation to maritime and emergency communications. With the demand for spectrum continually increasing, policymakers and industry leaders are grappling with how to use spectrum more efficiently. They're also grappling with the increase in the use of the underutilized spectrum and in the development of new technologies to unlock other avenues for enhancing spectrum value. Our very distinguished panel that I'm so pleased to be with and I will introduce momentarily will discuss the ongoing struggle between and among spectrum users in what we hope will be a robust debate over our wireless future. Our first panelist today is Brian Fonts. Brian Fonts currently serves as the Chief Executive Officer for the National Emergency Number Association, a position he has held since June of 2008. As CEO, he is responsible for all aspects of this association, and his primary objectives are to ensure that Americans have access to reliable 911 service, that 911 centers have state-of-the-art technologies and well-trained professionals, and that sufficient funding is available so that the 911 system can best serve those who call upon it as their first voice of hope. Prior to joining the association, Fonts was Vice President Federal Relations for Singular Wireless and served in that capacity after its acquisition by AT&T. Prior to that, he was Senior Vice President for Policy and Administration at the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association. And before that, he served as a senior advisor to the Commissioner for the Federal Communications Commission and as the FCC's Chief of Staff. Fonts started his professional career as a professor of communications at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he has received a PhD in mass media telecommunications from Michigan State University's Department of Telecommunications and an MSBS from Brigham Young University. Please join me in welcoming Brian Fonts.
Good morning. Thank you.
Our next speaker today will be Thomas C. Power. We're particularly delighted that Mr. Power has taken time from his busy schedule to be with us. He is the U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Telecommunications at the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the Executive Office of the President. Try to say that three times fast. I wonder how you introduce yourself with that long of a title. As Deputy CTO, Mr. Power helps develop and coordinate administration policy on telecom and technology issues. Before joining OSTP in August 2011, Mr. Power served as the Chief of Staff of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration at the Department of Commerce. At NTIA, Mr. Power provided managerial and policy support for a wide range of agency activities, including internet policy making, Spectrum and Recovery Act broadband grant programs. Prior to joining the NTIA, Mr. Power served for 9 years as general counsel of FiberLink Communications in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. From 1994 to 2000, he served in several supervisory roles at the FCC before being named senior legal advisor to FCC Chairman Kennard, advising the chairman on broadband, common carrier, and mass media matters. Before joining the FCC, he was a telecommunications litigation partner at Winston & Strawn, and he received his degrees in undergraduate and law from the University of Virginia. Please welcome Mr. Power. And last but certainly not least, we're pleased to welcome Janice Obuchowski. Janice Obuchowski is president of Freedom Technologies, and she's held many leadership positions both in the United States government and in the private sector. Mrs. Obuchowski served as the United States Ambassador to the World Radio Communications Conference 2003 in Geneva, Switzerland, and as Assistant Secretary for Communications and Information at the Department of Commerce under President George H.W. Bush. Mrs. Obuchowski also held several positions at the Federal Communications Commission, including Senior Advisor to the Chairman. Her private sector career includes founding and leading FTI for 18 years. She also has board service in a number of boards and corporate experience and entrepreneurship experience. She has served on boards including Orbital Sciences Corporation, CSG, Stratus Global, and Qualcomm. Early in her career, she was a 9X. She was at 9X and is in private antitrust law. She currently serves as an elected executive committee member of the Federal Communications Bar Association and is an appointed member of the Commerce Department's Spectrum Management Advisory Committee. She earned a JD from Georgetown University Law Center, where she was an editor of the Law Journal and was honored as Alumna of the Year in 2005. She graduated from honors from Wellesley College. Please welcome Mrs. Obachowski. I think you're going to take it away for us, Brian.
Thank you. We're just going to kind of take it away from our chairs here. I'm honored to be with you today and to be on a panel with two friends of mine that we've known each other for quite a while and have had an opportunity to work together very closely over the years. This is a fun area, believe it or not. When you talk about Spectrum, you're talking about an incredible array of issues, incredible array of, battles, if you will, and certainly differences of opinion as how to best achieve what the public policy or spectrum policy is. Now, that's the real tricky issue. What's the spectrum policy issue? Okay, so what is spectrum policy? Why do we have it? Who and what sets the policy? And why is it all that important? So how many of you in the room today, let's show by the raising of the hands here, have iPhones or Droids? Okay, great. So let's just give this a context. The wireless industry today is about, the commercial wireless industry is about 28 years old. So actually many of you in this room know no other form of telecommunication because it was around when you were born. But interestingly enough, over the last 28 years, we have seen the number of wireless connections in this country grow from zero to 310 million wireless connections. And that number is growing constantly. We've exceeded our population, basically, by the number of wireless connections that exist in the United States. Oftentimes, talk to groups and they will have teenagers either as siblings or children or grandchildren. And it wasn't that long ago, it was just a couple of years ago, teenagers used to text about, 3,400 text messages a month. Now that number has gone up to around 5,400 text messages a month. So you can tell whether these teenagers are average, below average, or above average by the amount of texting they do on a monthly basis. But it's amazing to see what's happened in the world of wireless communications today. In the United States, we are north of 30%, somewhere probably around, realistically around 35% of the U.S. households that are wireless only are closely approaching 35%. And then when you factor in the number of households that are wireless only or who prefer wireless communication, you're surpassing the majority of telecommunication consumers out there. So it's nice that we have our wireless services. And if you, like me, get upset every now and then when the service drops or the call drops or it's not fast enough, all of that is spectrum dependent. And the goal, of course, is to ensure that consumers have what they want. A lot of it is designed in the network, and a lot of it is utilizing the spectrum of which that network is able to operate on. So now, let's take a look at spectrum policy for a second. What is it? Why do we have it? Who's involved in it? Et cetera. The whole notion of spectrum policy formulation takes place in a variety of different areas in Washington. For the broad part of the commercial world, and my colleagues, I ask you to keep me honest here, a lot of this is defined by Congress and given authority to the FCC in terms of what the FCC can do, and they have literally quite a bit of discretion in the world of spectrum. We've often heard about spectrum auctions. That's authority given by Congress to the Commission. It's usually governing specific spectrum bands. You've probably heard in the news, the whole issue of incentive auctions. It's another policy governing providing incentives to those who currently occupy spectrum to vacate that spectrum so that that spectrum could be used for other purposes. You'll also see policy formulated at the White House, and Tom will be able to talk about that in a moment. And it's a bit of a different issue in that context, because now it is perhaps more political than just the FCC operating as independent regulatory agency. Nonetheless, they have the right to establish presidential policy under directives from the White House to the government users of the spectrum, and also to work with members of Congress to impose laws or vote laws that would govern or provide spectrum policy. So those are the key bodies of spectrum policy makers. Congress, the White House are the two significant bodies. The implementors of those policies involve the Federal Communications Commission and the National Telecommunication Information Administration, where Tom also worked within the Department of Commerce. So you have enough very interesting players in the whole formulation of spectrum policy positions. And what's happening today in the world that we live in is that we have a tremendous demand for spectrum for the provisioning of the services that we enjoy on a daily basis. And we also have, on the government side, the use of spectrum, whether it's efficiently used or inefficiently used, for a variety of services that our government provides to our nation, whether it's defense, security, or other forms of communications. So what do we do with the competing demands for spectrum and the fact that spectrum isn't becoming readily available in the time frame in which commercial users would like to access spectrum? Well, there's a lot of things that are being done. On the commercial industry side of the equation, there's efforts to improve the networks that the commercial operators have. They become more spectrum efficient, if you will. They have smart antennas and other intelligence in the network to be able to utilize aspects of that spectrum in ways that really provide greater efficiency in the use of spectrum that didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago. But oftentimes, that is simply not enough. I think when AT&T introduced the iPhone, it was about a matter of 2 years later, they saw an 8,000% increase in the data use part of the network. So that's a phenomenal growth in a very short period of time, and yet still trying to maintain that quality of service to consumers. So at that point, and at other points in a commercial network's history in provisioning service, they have to make a determination of how to either continue to improve the network and or get additional spectrum. And the getting additional spectrum boils down in two general camps. They can go out and try to acquire another company, in large part to acquire the spectrum and perhaps some of the other assets of the company, but spectrum is probably the key component to it. Or they can go and ask government to allocate additional spectrum for commercial use. And we have both of those approaches taking place today in our country. We've seen acquisitions, Verizon purchasing Altel. We've seen the proposed acquisition of T-Mobile by AT&T. And it goes on and on and on. These are perhaps the most current ones in the last few years. So that's kind of in a nutshell what the efforts are to try to secure the additional spectrum to provision the service and to meet the consumer demands that exist today. There's the network efficiencies, and there's also simply the use of spectrum. I'm not sure if I've been speaking for about 10 minutes or not, but I'll be quiet at this point, and then we're gonna go into some Q&A after my colleagues present their comments.
So, Tom, are you going to tell us why government needs to play a role in the allocation of this spectrum?
I will do my best. So thank you, Judge Elrod, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me here, and I'm very honored to be with my friends Janice and Brian, who are truly experts in this town and in this country on these issues. I thought what I would do is talk about a legislative proposal that the President has made. It was actually part of the Jobs Act that was sent up a month or so ago that includes specific provisions on spectrum. Just to put it in context and to reiterate a couple things Brian said, the two major federal agencies involved here are the FCC, which regulates the commercial providers like T-Mobile and AT&T and Verizon, and then the Commerce Department and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration within the Commerce Department that manages use of spectrum by federal agencies, which is a lot. It's not thought of as much by the average consumer, but whether it's air traffic control or covert surveillance by the FBI or the Defense Department, which is probably the biggest user, an endless array of uses in the federal side that are managed by NTIA. Brian talked about the shortage of spectrum that many are feeling, and as a first step to address that, the President last year issued an executive memorandum directing NTIA to work with the FCC to find 500 megahertz of spectrum that could be reallocated to commercial wireless broadband use. And to put that in context, that would about double the amount that's currently available. He set a 10-year timeline for doing that, and NTIA is now at work going through the bands of spectrum to identify spectrum that could be turned over to commercial use. More recently, as I said, in the Jobs Act, the administration sent up a proposal for spectrum policy, and I guess there are probably five elements to it. The first, which Brian alluded to, is incentive auctions. This is, although auctions have been conducted by the FCC for about 20 years to allocate spectrum commercially, the new part about incentive auctions is it's sort of a two-way auction because it allows the incumbent license holder who gives up the spectrum to receive a portion of the proceeds from the auction as an incentive, as hence incentive auctions. So we very much want to see that happen. Broadcasters in particular are the likely beneficiaries, if you will, in terms of volunteering their spectrum, so they would get a cut of the proceeds of the auction. A few other pieces to the legislation in no particular order. One is we actually want to take a piece of those proceeds, about 1% as it turns out, from those auctions and invest it in research and development. One of the questions, one of the basic questions here is where is the spectrum going to come from? There's a finite amount of it. We either have to figure out how to use it more efficiently, reallocate it among users, and or develop new technologies to help us use it more efficiently. And I can go into more description of that, but federal R&D in this area is underway, has proven beneficial, just as it has proven beneficial in many other ways, going back to packet technology that was first developed by the Defense Department, leading actually to the technology that underlies the internet today. So anyway, the second part is a little bit of R&D money. The third part is just as we give incentives to broadcasters and other commercial holders to make spectrum available to commercial use, we want to create, make sure the incentives for federal agencies are also right. Currently, the law says that when spectrum is given up by federal agencies and auctioned off, a portion of that money goes into a fund, which then reimburses the agencies for the costs incurred in planning and designing the abandonment of the spectrum they're getting off of, as well as the design of systems to go into new spectrum. We want to make some tweaks to that provision to do a couple things, but essentially to make sure that those incentives are there. We think it's going to work on the commercial side. It should also work on the government side. The fourth piece is the design and build out of a single wireless network for the benefit of first responders for public safety. This would be a nationwide interoperable network that would hopefully address one of the tragedies of 9/11, where firemen couldn't talk to cops, the cops from New Jersey couldn't talk to the cops from New York. And that is a long history to that. You know, the development of the systems that first responders use over the decades have sort of developed in a siloed way. The cops develop their system, the fire department develops theirs, the police in Arlington did it separately from the police in Washington, who did it separately from the police in Maryland. The goal is to have an interoperable network so that when the first responders from Mississippi go to New Orleans to respond to the hurricane, it's just plug and play. The state line, the fact that they're crossing a state line is immaterial. They can continue to operate. There are lots of issues to be solved there. We see a very big role for the private side in this in terms of sharing infrastructure. And also being able to lease spectrum that would be given to the public safety community as part of this network, so that when there is not a need for it on the public safety side, commercial users can be using it, and so can their consumers. And then the last point I'll touch on is this distinction between licensed spectrum on the commercial side and unlicensed spectrum. Typically, we think of spectrum in these auctions as providing a license to the spectrum holder to have exclusive use of that spectrum in some geographical area. There has also been developing, though, what we call unlicensed spectrum. And this is just as it sounds. No one has rights to it. I can probably best illustrate it by giving you some examples, but wireless microphones, garage door openers, baby monitors, wireless baby monitor where you can hear if the baby wakes up in the middle of the night. And then the biggest use is Wi-Fi, or at least the most obvious use is Wi-Fi. It's been a huge, huge success story in terms of innovation. One of the key things is there's a very low cost of entry. All you need to do is build a device. It has to get certified by the FCC. The FCC does impose some rules because basically what unlicensed does is operate in smaller geographical areas like wireless microphones or when you wave your card at the Starbucks, inventory tracking inside a given area. It operates over smaller distances, so the systems basically have to be powered down so as not to interfere with other uses. We want to see more of that. We think it's been a great success story. We think a balanced approach to having both licensed and unlicensed is what makes the most sense. There are some details in the legislation as to how that works. The big question is, what spectrum? Because there is some spectrum that everybody likes to get their hands on because it has the best propagation characteristics. It can go through walls. It just travels better than other spectrum that is harder to find appropriate uses for. So that is the administration's legislative package in a nutshell, and I will turn it over to Janice.
Thank you. Okay, folks, I'm going to stand up. I was listening to my guidance that somebody might be getting CLE credit here, and so I put together some slides, and I'm trying to show how future-oriented I am. I have my iPad here. Doesn't mean I'm going to drive it all that well. I too want to thank you for being here. This always comes across as a bit of an arcane topic, but it's a critical topic. And I also want to comment on how honored I am by my colleagues on this panel. Every one of us, I think, cares deeply about this and has thought hard about the role of this unique commodity. I think of it as the essential property of the information age. And some of the issues that pertain. I'd like to cover three topics that I think are a little bit underappreciated in the spectrum policy environment. And I'm not sure I'm going to get through all my slides. You can give me your cards and I'll send them to you and you can claim CLE credit. Everybody agrees, and I want to honor this president and this group of individuals, Larry Strickling at NTIA and Julius Genachowski for highlighting the role of wireless and spectrum in our economy going forward. What I would say, however, is that as this debate moves forward, one aspect which Tom actually emphasized but is underappreciated is the role of spectrum to the U.S. military and to users other than the commercial players who kind of have the largest mic. One of the frustrations I've had with the execution of the 500 megahertz plan is that, at least as originally envisioned, the president's 500 megahertz would come sort of shared out of the coffers of underutilized FCC commercial spectrum and out of the coffers of government users. But frankly, while I give this administration an A for policy vision, I give it a gentleman's grade for execution. Because when you come to the execution part of spectrum policy, you really get into the nitty gritty. There is no unused spectrum anymore. So you're really thinking about taking real estate away from some entity that has become very comfortable residing in that real estate and moving it or sharing it. And sharing sounds good, but have you ever been asked to share a bathroom? Nobody really likes to share. We do it if we have to. And this is kind of part of the dynamic where I think the gentleman's grade comes into play. Because when the Obama administration had the ability to drive some of the hard nuts and bolts decisions to free spectrum, where it had, you know, a mandate, it didn't move comfortably in the area of repossessing spectrum. Rather, it continued with the policy but never wrested the spectrum back. So we now find ourselves in an election year where we can talk about broadcaster spectrum, but I don't think anybody can really do much about advancing that. First off, the broadcasters have a legitimate concern. A lot of them really didn't get that spectrum from the government. They bought it in some secondary market. They've built businesses. And on the flip side, even though politicians will talk about reclaiming the spectrum in an election year, nobody's really going to do that. And you know, that's just the reality of the situation. D block. Before Vice President Biden, out of the best of intention, decided that this should go to the cause of public safety, even the FCC Chairman Jenikowski and then ranking member, well then Chair Waxman, thought that wasn't a very good idea. Public safety actually has plenty of spectrum. As with a lot of users, it underutilizes it. It uses it for narrowband. It, you know, these, you have communities where the police don't talk to the fire, don't talk to, you know, the ambulance, whatever. It's been essentially mismanaged. So while interoperability is key, throwing more spectrum at it would be a major mistake. You don't reward some failures of governance by saying, you know, get back to the trough, take the most valuable asset. I think what you do, and frankly, $8 billion, which the administration puts forward for this network, is pennies when it comes to really building and then maintaining a state-of-the-art network. Any police officer, fireman, whoever, who wants to go for broadband has a very good comparator right in his pocket, his iPhone. And if you think $8 billion is going to, you know, build a network that provides that kind of power, information, and then maintains it, you're misguided. So even people in private, people who have no axe to grind, will say there's a moral hazard in this particular approach. Because if the money is given, it will certainly be spent. Will it be spent prudently? In my estimation, probably not. I think people have to rethink this. I think there is a need for the $8 billion to go. It should go selectively to hardening networks, putting more functionality in where the commercial players can't really, forget the iPad, see, this isn't working. Putting more functionality in the pockets of our hardworking public safety players where the commercial networks don't support their efforts, but it certainly will not build the network that everybody thinks these people should access. Public-private partnership is key. Allocating more spectrum directly to the public safety community is not, nor is an $8 billion commitment to this, absent some real reform in the governance structure of public safety. Who gets the money? Who uses the money? How is it deployed? You know, when we do our family budgets, we form those opinions before we give out the candy to the kids. And I don't mean to be pejorative by that. I really don't. But it's just, we're putting the cart before the horse. It's a mistake we've made in the past. We shouldn't be making it now. I am concerned about three things, and I'll allude to them quickly. Number one, I mentioned that I don't, and you can look at the slides later, but I mentioned that I currently do a fair amount of work for the U.S. military. There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about how America has always had a unique ability to, a unique way of fighting, going from the frontier wars to being an expeditionary nation in the big world wars, to now having to deal with, you know, threats at home and asymmetric warfare. We fight in a unique way, and the way we've been able to succeed has been to use the available technology to the best of its ability. Guess what? For an expeditionary nation fighting asymmetric warfare, spectrum is key. You look at your average platform, you know, any kind of airplane that you'll send into a combat situation, they have 55 different spectrum-dependent systems on them. You look at the fact that if you look at the Air Force Academy today, last year, it's the first year they graduated more drone pilots than they graduated pilots. And guess what? That's saving lives, and that's probably our ace in the hole going forward. All those technologies are spectrum dependent. I get very tired of hearing the rhetoric out of the commercial players that say the spectrum's going to waste. Yeah, some of it can be improved, but so can some of the commercial spectrum. And that's a dynamic that really concerns me going into this next year when you talk about the search for 500 megahertz and you talk about an FCC, which at this point is in an election cycle and really can't move particularly aggressively. And who, you know, does the president have the ability to, by direction, reclaim spectrum from? That would be the government players. And they're good soldiers and they will, you know, do what's needed. But it's of concern and it has to be done right. And I actually compliment Tom and I compliment his boss, Larry Strickling at NTIA, because I think in testimony, Larry's been very articulate about the trade-offs. The second point I want to make is one that's kind of a personal bee in my bonnet. I got into a discussion with somebody I admire a whole lot about the fact that the march of technology and wireless technology and broadband is relentless. Of course, that's true. And he said, Janice, you don't want to put that back in the box. I said, no, I can't. I don't. But spectrum, you know, wireless technology is bringing every temptation in the world into my 17-year-old son's iPhone 24 hours a day, from bad ideas that his friends might have, to porn, to just sheer distraction that keeps him away from his homework. And, you know, as a mom, I can do my best, and I am, and, you know, we can moderate, we can limit hours, and we do all that. But the fact is, broadband is neutral. And as a nation, we really have to be thinking as we go forward, what do we do with this powerful tool? One of the interesting things you've seen is how, you know, the broadband was so, and wireless was so influential in the Arab Spring. That's pretty good. I mean, people were communicating, they were communicating wirelessly. At the same time, the Iranians were using wireless to send out hoax messages. You know, if you oppose so-and-so, show up at X Square, and these people were slaughtered. So this is not a value, you know, uniformly positive thing. And then you talk about the great, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, I think, statement about shouting fire in a crowded room. You know, even the First Amendment doesn't protect that. We just had a flash mob in Germantown, Maryland, where, you know, somebody put out the word, show up at 7-Eleven. Within 2 minutes, this poor Pakistani guy's shelves were cleaned out before the cops could do a thing. These are very, very powerful tools, and we have just begun to think about what we can do about them. And I just kind of throw that out as a concern. I think it's people here in the Federalist Society and in all sorts of, you know, pro-democratic operations who really have to think about what this means for the future of the country and the world. And then last but not least, because you guys are lawyers, as are we, I guess Brian accepted. He brings a real intellectual pedigree to the table. One of the interesting things you have to think about as you look at spectrum policy and regulation in an increasingly constrained environment is that we are going to have to talk about sharing spectrum where people wanted exclusive rights. We have to talk about things like enforcement. Historically, FCC relied on post hoc enforcement of spectrum management, of interference. Frankly, in the world in which we operate, that is a almost an exercise in futility, because if somebody is interfering with somebody else, by the time you get through the regulatory process, and if that person is determined enough and takes you to court, you've just lived through a couple generations of wireless technology. So increasingly, and I'm happy to see this, and it's coming through in this CSMAC, this Commerce Spectrum Management Advisory Committee, a lot of people are thinking about it. Since wireless increasingly is networked, or can be made to be networked, we really need a lot of before the fact prophylactic rules that basically say any piece of wireless technology has to have the ability to ping the network and in some instances be shut down if there are forms of interference. This came out of a discussion I had with somebody at Intel who's been pretty articulate about it. We really have to be thinking about how we can make technology work for us to do some of the enforcement, because frankly, in the fast-moving world of wireless, you know, the conventional, and in the world of sharing, conventional tools just really aren't going to help us. And as lawyers, I think we can be at the forefront of thinking about that and how do we make enforcement work in the world of very, very quick technology evolution, but very careful and slow judicial process. So that being said, I think I've taken my 10 minutes, and thanks. And now I'll take my iPad, which really wasn't used.
Thank you very much. Well, Tom Jenness had some strong words for the allocation of the D block exclusively to public safety. I think she said that there wasn't a public safety need, and that perhaps that wasn't the best and highest use of that very important resource. But I know that the administration very much favors that. Did you want to take a moment to respond?
Sure. So I think there have been two approaches proposed here. One is what the administration has proposed, which is taking a swath of spectrum, giving it to a entity to manage it on behalf of the public safety first responders, and then leasing excess capacity to commercial users who could use it when the public safety community didn't need it. The other vision is auction it, and if there, to the extent there is a need for public safety to have access to it, you give them some kind of priority rights to it so they could intervene at the time of the emergency. And the rest of the time, it would just be held by the commercial providers. It's sort of like, you know, who's the landlord and who's the tenant. But operate, or you know, maybe a better example is the mortgage, right? Do I own the house or does the bank own the house? You know, we're really just about defining rights. The mortgage is a piece of paper that allocates rights and responsibilities. But I'm going to live in the house and I'm going to owe you money and I'm going to write checks to you every month as my banker. It's sort of the same thing here, and just the question is what's the best way just to make it work? And I think for me the deciding factor is well, I guess two things I'll point to. One is that you I think by giving the spectrum to the public safety community in terms of their negotiations with the commercial providers, I just think those negotiations will actually work better if the public safety community walks into the room with the spectrum. But it's tied to the second issue, and Janice touched on it too, which is the governance structure. As we've discussed, the problem over time has been you've got all these different entities all over the country, thousands of them, trying to solve this on their own, and more recently trying to solve it together, and it just hasn't worked real well. It's such a distributed group. So I think if you could put the spectrum in the hands of some kind of board or entity that would manage it overall, contract with the private industry to build out the network, to lease capacity from existing private vendors and their infrastructure, and have a uniform set of standards and rules set for the national level, and then executed locally, to me, that's just the best mix.
Great. I'd like to respond to both Janice and Tom, because I think this makes an excellent case study. If anybody wants to just study a spectrum issue, the D block has an interesting and unique history, and it makes for great study. It started out in the Congress telling the FCC that it must auction off the spectrum in the 700 megahertz band, and there were specific blocks of spectrum that were auctioned off. By the way, public safety received 24 megahertz of spectrum in the 700 megahertz band. They are using some of that spectrum for narrowband, which would be the only narrowband use in that whole 700 megahertz band. So the FCC went ahead and held an auction of the D block, and they set up a minimal threshold bid, and they also set up some preliminary conditions for the commercial entity working with the public safety entity. And then one of the flaws, if you will, and it's so easy to talk about it in hindsight, was the fact that the winner, the commercial winner of the D block, would then, after the auction, negotiate with the public safety entity. And if you could not come to an agreement and the commercial entity walked away, you would still have to leave a substantial sum of money on the table. So there was some strange, you know, in hindsight, some strange processes associated with it. So moving from that time period, if you take a look at all of the public safety organizations, they thought that it would clearly be beneficial to partner with a commercial entity. The same reasons that we enjoy the advances in technology today. We have the iPhone 1, 2, 3, 4S. We have, I don't know what iteration of Droid we're in now. But it's a way of keeping the technology current and keeping the network upgraded. So many of those in public safety today who are advocating for the reallocation of the D block supported that public-private partnership for all of those reasons, to keep the network current and to ensure that they had the latest and greatest technology. Something changed between 2008 and today, where public safety decided that not only do we want our 24 megahertz, but we want that additional 10 megahertz block. And, you know, you talk to any number of people in public safety, you'll probably get a unique answer from each individual as to what changed. But one of the things that I found particularly interesting, and now I'm going to speak from my role in the commercial world, that, and I've frequently talked to my public safety colleagues about the concept of leasing excess capacity. There are two elements with that. If you have excess capacity, then do you need spectrum? That's the first argument. The second argument is, if you lease excess capacity, exactly where does that money from the lease go? When I was in the commercial world and we would co-locate on towers owned by city governments or counties or villages, we wrote a check to the city manager. And so the money eventually went back into the community, some of which may have gone to the police, fire, or EMS folks. Very little of it would go to 911, I might add. Personal grind. But in any event, that whole study of the D block, whether you advocate for the reallocation of it or not, is a unique case study, if you will, in all of the various forces that are associated with spectrum policy. Because all of a sudden now, it's no longer an issue with public safety and Congress, who directs the FCC to change the law or not, reallocating the D block. It now becomes a presidential issue. You know, it's an administration issue. It was actually referenced in the State of the Union and other speeches. So now it escalates it. And for those who are really familiar with Washington, you know what happens in that level. And so it's a beautiful, brilliant, concise case study of public policy addressing spectrum management.
May I ask a question then? The current law explicitly orders the FCC to auction the D block, doesn't it? Is that correct?
Yep. Yes.
Then why isn't the FCC doing that now?
Good question. I think we probably all have our own answers. I'm pointing to you guys over there.
I can't speak for the commission, but I suspect in large part it's deference to Congress what's going on the Hill is as this issue gets debated.
So in the meantime, the FCC doesn't have to comply with the existing law, and the president is not inclined to make them because he has a different policy in mind. Is that correct? And the Congress is debating new policies, so the current law is not being complied with. And is this a source of potential revenue that could help the super committee if they would comply with the current law?
Well, everything is a source of potential revenue, that's for sure.
But it's not just the D block. So to answer a question, Tom and Janice, keep me honest here as well. Whenever Congress is debating an issue that would affect a regulatory agency, in this case, the FCC, oftentimes the FCC, and Tom is absolutely right, out of due deference to the body to whom the FCC has to go to for oversight, they will basically bow down to that authority as they discuss and debate the issue. And they usually give them an amount of time to go through and address it. And it's not just the D block that type of deference takes place. It's a number of different policy issues. So I don't want anybody to think that this is just a unique thing for D block in terms of providing deference to Congress. But you are right, it is a law. Congress, or the FCC, I do believe, is giving deference to Congress. And I think it was Commissioner McDowell, who is a Republican member of the commission. The commission has three Dems, or normally has three Dems in a Democratic administration, two Republicans, flips with a Republican administration with three Republicans, two Dems. And I think it was McDowell who said that that Congress should have a period of time to address the issue, but if they don't address it, then the commission should move forward. And the reallocation of the D block wasn't raised just in this Congress, it was raised in the last Congress. So, I'm not, trying to voice an opinion yay or nay on the D block. What I'm trying to do is to say it's a brilliant, succinct case study of spectrum policy.
I wanted to just sort of make a simple comment for those of you who haven't worked at the FCC. The best advice I ever got at the FCC was regulation, if it's going to be effective, is always a game of leverage. You have huge powers at play. You have politics, you have very big money, you have conflicting agendas. And if you're going to be effective as a regulator, you should think of your role as limited but strong. And by that, it is to articulate the objective and then make it in the interests of the industry or whichever players you want to impact to want to execute that policy for you. And that's where I think the current philosophy of the D block is absolutely wrong. It's giving the candy before you get the act. We have a desperate need in this country for interoperability. 10 years after 9/11, we still don't have the answers. Some of the faults have to do with the government. A lot of the fault has to do with the industry and with public safety as a group of players. The technology exists. You can do interoperability without building a network. You can do that in the switch. That might not have been the case years ago, but you can do it now as a matter of programming. That's not happened because the governance hasn't squared itself away. So as far as I'm concerned, this is not as complicated as it sounds. It's a matter of government doing what government ought to be doing, and instead of politicking and throwing out gambits and various electioneering things, it should articulate the objective and then say, you will get this reward, be it the $8 billion or access to the D block, maybe not possession of, but access to, if you're able to accomplish the following. And I think the D block is a travesty. I was one of the people that was, involved in this early. I made my share of mistakes, and I'll own up to that. But it is a travesty, because at this point, it's not about getting to the answer that's correct. I think there's a whole aspect of this that is about politics.
There's one other thing, too, that Janice hit on here is interoperability. And it was in the last Congress, it was an oversight hearing, and in public safety, the standard for radio is the P25 standard. And after the horrific events of September 11th, where police and fire couldn't communicate with one another, vast sums of money was poured into buying more, allowing public safety entities to buy more of the P25 radios. And it was in the last Congress, a hearing that came out in that hearing, that the P25 standard, although it does have interoperability built into the standard, it is not truly functional. And you know, that was kind of a major awakening in terms of what, for the 20 years that it's been since, 20 or 25 years since P25 has been out there, deemed to be the incredible standard for interoperability, in reality didn't deliver interoperability. And when you look at the U.S. systems compared to systems around the world, we are probably a unique country in terms of tethering its public safety almost to a unique standard that doesn't allow for a lot of competition in the provisioning of technology. Whereas Europe has Tetra and a number of parties can build to that technology. So here in this country, we may have $3,000 radios that in Europe may be $700. So there's a historical mess, if you want to look at it that way, or a commitment that has taken place that's kind of locked us into something that I think now we realize probably was not the right thing to do.
Well, we're very glad to have Tom here, and he is our guest, and I think you should have the opportunity to have the last word on the D block, since you've had some comments from both sides. And
it's a tough issue. I sort of made the point. I think where Janice and I agree is governance is a real challenge, and fixing that is key, and that's why 10 years after 9/11 we've made very little progress. And I very much agree with what Brian just said. One of the other big problems we've had in the public safety community is the sort of proprietary standards that just drives the costs way up. We're very much want this nationwide standard, and we want it based on commercial standards as much as possible, because that's where you get the scale and drive the costs back down. There has to be some special apps and things like that for the public safety community, as with in any vertical. But relying as much as possible on what's going on in the commercial sector is crucial, because Brian said it exactly right. We're just buying these radios that are 5 or 10 times more expensive than they need to be.
I wanted to ask a general question for those in the room who may not have known what a D block was before they came in the room. I bet they know what the First Amendment is. And in general, we have not applied the First Amendment aggressively. That's a very broad statement, in the broadcast area, because it was a limited spectrum. But as we're talking about the vast expansion of spectrum, will the First Amendment come into play again in this area?
Let's hear from the non-lawyer on the panel, huh? I'll throw it out there. I've been accused of being a lawyer for 30 years now. Actually, I don't see it happening. In fact, I see just the opposite happening, is that, to Janice's point, that much of what is out there, the scarcity argument will still prevail where it's convenient to establish rules that would govern, if you will, content. We've gotten rid of some of those rules, fairness doctrine and others, over the years. But frankly, that's, you know, the truth be known, I think there's a lot of convenience with the argument of spectrum scarcity. On the flip side of the argument, where you're looking at spectrum in a wildly different way, so that it's the content delivered over spectrum associated with applications that are not tethered to any single licensee whatsoever, then your hook into any type of regulatory / legal action, I think, becomes much more complicated, if not impossible. So, you know, I think for the convenience sake of it all, I think people will just kind of not deal with the First Amendment. You know, I just think it just muddies the water and frankly will muddy the courts for years to come.
Yeah, and just to play it out, the argument would be that because spectrum is used as a means of communication, that any government regulation of it has to satisfy First Amendment criteria, which, as Brian said, in the broadcast world has historically been interpreted as actually giving the FCC a fair amount of regulatory discretion, things like content, for example. But that's shifting as obviously folks get the same content via different media, i.e. cable or satellite TV, which don't operate under the same rules, and the Supreme Court has upheld that so far, but I'm sure that's coming back. And then you could expand the argument, particularly if technology means spectrum is actually less scarce. As I alluded to earlier, there is technology being developed that would be a much more dynamic way of sharing spectrum so that the device can sense what spectrum is being used at any time and find the free spectrum, and that this would be on a dynamic basis. And if, you know, if it was really successful, at the end of the rainbow, it could greatly expand the amount of spectrum available to the point that the scarcity argument wouldn't hold together anymore. But I think from a technology, and then the First Amendment issue would come to the fore. I think from a technological standpoint, we're pretty far from there.
Okay. Thank you. Good question. Do we have questions in the audience?
Hi, Christopher DeCoro. One concern that I have when I look at the telecommunications industry is you see the enormous amount of market concentration and leading towards monopolization of, for example, if the AT&T T-Mobile merger goes through, you'll have basically three nationwide firms. And so I'm concerned about how can we use spectrum allocation policy to try to allow for better competition or lower barriers to entry or, you know, just general more players in this market and hopefully better stimulate competition? Or do any of you think that competition is not a problem in the telecommunications industry? Thank you.
I will stand for the point of view that at this point concentration isn't the issue it's been presented to be. I don't know whatever happened to the concept of intermodal competition, but most people and most places in this country have 2, 3, 4 wireless carriers accessing them. They're obtaining content over the air from broadcasters. They're obtaining content from cable companies. They're obtaining content from satellite companies. And there are still some very robust landline service providers. I don't think you'll ever have a situation where you're going to have large numbers of carriers building out nationwide wireless platforms. And this kind of gets to my point about the public safety network. The economics of these networks are amazing. I mean, a Verizon or an AT&T puts about $20 billion a year in upgrades. We are in a country that, as we know, is running deficits, and we're in, you know, a borderline recession slash growth mode, which isn't going to change anytime soon. And the notion that by throwing out some more spectrum, we're going to get another network built, I think is self-deceiving. I think the AT&T, I have no dog in the fight, but the antitrust arguments on AT&T T-Mobile, to my mind, again, well-intended by the people that are proffering them, but if you look at the facts, if that deal doesn't go through, the likely scenario is T-Mobile will sell to somebody else. And you read all the analysts about it, and they say, you know, you just cannot afford, you know, multiple coast-to-coast wireless networks.
I agree.
Just as a rejoinder, though, of course, that was the argument used for the de jure monopolization of AT&T throughout most of the last century. They asserted that they were a natural monopoly, that it was impracticable to have any other telephone company, and that it was essential to do that. And the Telecommunications Act of 1996 attempted to enforce co-location requirements and other things which the carriers have pushed back on thanks to their allies in Congress, and so you no longer have that. But of course, that was the exact same argument that was shown to be false back in the 80s.
But actually it's not, because I'm not arguing for a natural monopoly. I'm arguing for numerous wireless competitors, some regional, some national. Two or three, Sprint.
Slightly more.
Okay, right, thank you. And intermodal competition. So this isn't an ATT scenario where there's one company coast to coast operating basically all access to the network.
Anybody else want to respond to that question before we proceed to the next question?
And I'll try to be very brief. I mean, there have been efforts to try to distribute the spectrum to entities that are not large regional or national corporations. And in reality, if you go back and take a look at that and do an assessment over the years, most of that spectrum was probably bought up for a variety of reasons. One, to get to the level in which your investment makes an actual return on that investment, these networks are not inexpensive to build, maintain, and operate. And so I think a lot of folks realize that, you know, this is just sheer business, and the business is such that, you know, I can't make it work, so I'm going to sell out to either a regional carrier, or the regional carrier turns out and sells out to a larger carrier, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the real issue, I think, that ties into all of this. We talked about it early on, about the two avenues, in essence, of obtaining spectrum in order to continue to meet consumer demand. And the government process, this, and I totally agree with Tom and Janice with how important it is to set a goal of identifying and reallocating additional spectrum for commercial use. But in reality, that's about a 10-year process, probably at best. And so when you're operating a network, whether you're a small entity or a large entity, and you see consumer demands of 8,000% growth on data networks alone, and the introduction of a new product, you're panicking, because you're sitting here thinking, where am I going to get the spectrum to meet what the consumers want? And when you tie that to stats about more and more households are going wireless only, how do you meet it? You know, how do you continue to provide that service? I think that's really the underlying current in what's happening with what I call probably just the natural marketplace evolving.
If it would take 10 years to accomplish the president's agenda in this area to add this, assuming that were correct, are we going to come to a screeching halt in the meantime? Is it all going to go along and it's going to be okay?
Well, I want to compliment what Tom said about Wi-Fi, because one of the things we haven't really touched upon where government has made a great deal of headway and could do even more is promoting efficiency. Solving this problem of the iPhones and the insatiable desire for more capacity is part a spectrum problem and part an efficiency problem. And one of the real breakthroughs that Unlicensed has been able to accomplish, you'll often see it now on your iPhone, right? It's all the time. You know, will you turn over to the Wi-Fi? It's a way of much more efficiently building out your networks, because you're aggregating a lot of requirement at the local level, therefore not needing these massive swaths of spectrum, you know, which cell technology essentially requires. So, you know, I think it's going to be a marriage both of efficiency as well as of more spectrum. I think both ought to play to America's strengths. We still don't necessarily build all the handsets, but we have been very good at innovating with technology for networks. And I hope that, you know, we get the calculus right, that we put out sufficient spectrum so that we can continue to lead with broadband, but that we also just don't open the spigot, because that's not going to guarantee that we apply our technology as forward-leaning as we could.
Tom, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Yeah, this Wi-Fi and other unlicensed uses, and it speaks to the competitive issue as well, too. If you're in Times Square and you have a AT&T smartphone and you're trying to get connected to the internet, you're going to be on Wi-Fi. They've installed thousands of Wi-Fi hotspots there, as has other providers all over the world. The demand has just been so strong. And again, the beauty of this unlicensed stuff is the lower barrier to entry. You don't pay a big auction price. You don't get an exclusive license either, and you have to work out these sharing things, which are difficult. But you just develop a really smart device. And it has in the industry, smart grid, healthcare, it is all over the place on an unlicensed basis. It's something we really need to preserve and grow.
Do we have another question?
Yeah, it's actually two questions, and one of which is on the mobile data offload over Wi-Fi spectrum. There's new technologies out there that can do that seamlessly in the network without it having a device on the client, which is obviously going to help that, and with the proliferation of small cells. I think you guys are spot on, and I want to compliment this panel. And very unlike many other, you know, I think this administration, where I disagree with it in many policy areas, has done a great job, Tom, on the wireless side. The question I have is, what can it do better, right? So you put in the Jobs Act a provision about further spectrum auction, but there's things now, right now, pending before the FCC, is Dish Network's approval of the acquisition of DBSD and TerreStar. And Dish is on record in their last quarterly earnings and the previous quarterly earnings saying, I can't wait to get this approval so I can start building out. The amount of jobs that creates, and he's going to build a fresh network. And this goes to the other the question before is, well, you know, isn't part of the administration's policy, if someone's going to be silly enough to throw that much capital at it, let's go. Let's encourage that and let's make it happen. As it is, that's still pending before the FCC and a merger that happened over a year ago. Fine, it was filed in August, but is there things that can happen now? The FCC can encourage that. The opposition was ridiculous. It was from self-interested parties. Let's approve it, get it on, and say, you know, go, move as fast as you can. The same thing with LightSquared. And Janice, I think this is where, you know, some of this, there's a technology issue that can be solved, but you have a market entry party who wants to put a lot of money behind a mobile broadband network. And obviously, the more data that's taken off the networks, the better that is for the cell phones, because you're not going to have overloaded circuits, right? But why isn't the administration pushing that forward? There are things now and here. Like I said, it's overall a great job, and there's some good thinkers up here, but there's simple things that can be done now that aren't being done. And I'm wondering if the administration can't sort of, you know, put the boot in. And one last comment. I love that this panel said with a straight face that the FCC was deferring to Congress, without the little thing at the end that says when it's in its interest. I'm glad you could say that with a straight face.
Okay, so the question then is about the administration.
Yeah.
So
on these satellite issues, it's an interesting issue. The authorizations that were given to these companies initially required them to do a shared use and actually to rely primarily on satellite communications. So you'd have a phone that would talk to the satellite, and it was at one point thought that this was going to be great in really rural areas where it's going to be too expensive to build towers and all that. And then the terrestrial use, which is what most wireless broadband providers rely on, would be ancillary to the satellite use. And so we've had entities come forward and basically say, I'd like to just make use of the terrestrial and not do the satellite. And those are the matters that are pending in front of the FCC. We sort of have to respect the FCC process. And by the way, the FCC is an independent agency. So it's not part of the administration. It's not like we can tell them what to do. We can file comments. We can encourage them just as anybody in this room can. It's not something we can direct them to do. But I think the issue that's been holding it up has simply been interference concerns, that if they, instead of using primarily satellite communications, they use exclusively terrestrial communications, that's a much bigger use of that spectrum that could interfere with other uses. But I agree, it does look like it's spectrum that could be put to a better use. We need to solve the interference issues and get that out there. And thank you for your other comments.
Okay. Do you have a question?
My question is about the public safety network, the $8 billion proposed public safety network, and I seem to recall in the 2000s there was the idea of the design of a particular block of spectrum that would be licensed to under a condition where you'd have to use it for public safety, and I think there was one bidder that bid on that spectrum, and that bidder went bankrupt pretty quickly, if I recall correctly. And I wanted to understand a little bit about how the business rationale for this particular network would end up working, whereas that one in the last decade where we saw a very similar circumstance didn't work out. That's one question. And a second question, if I can sneak in a second, is about military uses, and this one is for Janice. I don't know anything about military uses of spectrum, so I'm pleading ignorance. But with that said, when we're using spectrum for military purposes, and for example, taking out Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, I don't think that that affects our spectrum in the United States. And we're not asking for their permission, I think, when we're taking out those bad guys. So I'm wondering how it affects the uses of spectrum in the United States and not outside of the United States, where so far as I know, I don't think we're ever asking for permission, but if I'm wrong, I'd be happy to be wrong as well.
Well, I guess I'd make two observations. You look at how we took out Osama bin Laden. Those guys spent all of about 3 weeks outside of the United States. So when you look at the way we fight, we are now an expeditionary nation, and our top fighters, our crack fighters, come and go. They train here, they leave. So in fact, one of the big issues with the key ban that is, I mean, it's interesting how, you know, a lot of bans get tossed around, but really the commercial guys want one band, and that's 1750 and up for about 150 megahertz. And those bands are intensively used for training across many places. And the real issue there is, well, there are several issues, but one of the big issues is, will the commercial players accept the idea of exclusion zones, where those places where people are training will be excluded from the commercial license? And nobody likes that, because guess what? Some of those are in Southern California or right outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, one of the big growth markets for wireless in the country, not to mention New York and Boston. So it's really not a simple case. And by the way, when you look at how the U.S. military operates overseas, you're right. If you get into full combat, the first thing you saw them do in Iraq was just blow up the, you know, switching station. But that's not typically the way we're operating. We're operating as a nation generally under host nation agreements, and even places like Afghanistan, there's this great desire to build the commercial infrastructure so that the country can transition to civil society and we can get the heck out of there. So the idea that we're going to bomb the heck out of the country and then do what we please is really a very narrow part of U.S. military doctrine, thank God.
But yeah, it's the training and testing and all that, as Janice said, is what goes on here, and that's what really why you need it. On your first question, I was not in the spectrum battles back then, but as I think Brian sort of alluded to this, that there was an auction that was intended to give public safety some access. I think in retrospect, as Brian said, all the terms and conditions weren't spelled out. It was sort of like you win the auction and then you get the right to negotiate, and if the negotiations don't succeed, you have to give a lot of the money back to the government. Your deposit kind of goes back to the government. So going forward, I think if you did auction the D-block, you'd want to work those things out to a much greater degree before the auction, so the bidder knows what's they're really getting, what bundle of rights are they really getting. But it is, in my view, a reason why you might want to think about giving it to public safety and letting them just negotiate it, because I'm afraid for Congress or the FCC to try to think through all those conditions in advance, in a vacuum, in a context of not real-world negotiations with two people sitting across the table, is going to be a challenge. I think it might be better to let the public safety folks negotiate it, you know, in the bargaining room in real time.
And I'm going to make a very irreverent comment. You know, I've lived in Washington for almost 40 years now, and even so, I've become sympathetic to those that say, over time, people in Washington get very comfortable with their role inside Washington, and they become king role makers, and they become negotiators, and they're not necessarily anymore taking care of the overarching issues of a larger national constituency. Who is public safety? Who's going to be at the table? Are these people that have the mantra, the mantle, not the mantra, the mantle of all the people that we consider to be critical to this, or are these going to be a subset of kingmakers who may or may not be, you know, pursuing all the interests we want? And that, I want to know who those people are going to be before they get something worth billions of dollars to put as their chip on the table. That's where I get to the point of leverage. The point of leverage is now. Let the public safety people who are going to do the nation's bidding step forward, identify how they intend to proceed, and who they're going to be dealing with. And then, you know, the D block is going to go to public safety in an event of an emergency. That's not in anybody's, you know, that's not contested. Everybody agrees. Public-private partnerships say that. But the broader issue of how this governance operates, as I say, I tend to agree with somebody who was completely nonpartisan here that said it's a moral hazard the way this deal is currently structured.
What
just,
about?
Just for the record here, though, just so I represent an organization that deals with 911. This is not the Public Safety Broadband Network, so I don't want to get swept into this debate and discussion. What we have done differently than what our colleagues in the public safety radio world has done with, we've been working with state CIOs. And more times than not across the country now, the whole 911 area is moving into the state CIO umbrella. A lot of states have built their telecommunication networks, and they're trying to figure out what services could tie into that that would make a lot of sense. And what we have been working on is developing the standards that would allow what we all have in our hands today, voice, video, and data communication, to be able to communicate that information, rich messaging, into our nation's call centers that will ultimately tie in to those public safety folks who use the public safety broadband network. And I just wanted to make sure you understand the distinctions between my world in dealing with broadband and IP technology and standards and working with networks and commercial networks, et cetera, versus the public safety broadband network.
Well, that leads me to ask, why isn't this money turned over in block grants to the states so that they could interface with the state people and then thereby deal with people who really are dealing with public safety in the local areas?
For me, it gets back to just wanting to ensure that you have a nationwide interoperable network. There are a number of technical challenges, obviously, to building out a network. If you did it state by state, one of the big challenges would be if I'm the first responders from Mississippi and I'm running over to New Orleans when the hurricane hits, who's paying who? Because that's now the Louisiana network that I'm roaming onto, just as you can roam from Verizon onto AT&T. If it's just one network, then you don't worry about that. You're just using the same network. That's just one example. I just think the logistics might be solved better by having a uniform single entity directing it. Now, I know to a lot of folks that sounds like a big federal bureaucracy managing everything from Washington. And you know, particularly in at this event, I know
you're a brave man.
You know, and the Federalist Society, you know, is obviously very adept at reminding us to think about those kind of issues before trying to solve the nation's problems. I'll just say that, I mean, I'm not an education expert, so this is just me talking. But if seventh graders in Texas get taught differently than seventh graders in Maine, I don't really care. But this is supposed to be an interoperable network. And I think if AT&T was going to build an interoperable network, I don't think they would say, let's get the head of each of our offices in 50 states and let them each build out their own network and then we'll piece it together. That's not how the commercial world would do it. And I just don't think that's the way we should do it either.
And how we've been dealing with that, because we have taken the notion that, you know, in the 911 world, it's it is the ultimate of local. And to try to move 911 into a national decision-making body would be incredibly complex. There's 6,000 to 7,000 911 centers out there. But what we have been doing is establishing the standards for next generation 911 that would be utilized in technology across states, so that the standards for the technology, a federal concept, it could certainly be applied to our colleagues in the public safety broadband side of the equation. So, you know, there are so many challenges, and oddly enough, I think the most fundamental challenge is not spectrum per se, although for the broadband network, spectrum is critical. I think the primary challenge for 911 and public safety broadband network has everything to do with funding, everything to do with building and maintaining and operating the network and keeping technology and the network current. That's really what it is all about in better serving the citizens of this country. And so that's my issue.
Our time is wrapping up, but I did want to see if any of you wanted to discuss the concept of allocating more spectrum for unlicensed use in any more detail. People discussed it broadly in the introductory statements, but this is a very hot issue, and I wanted to see if anyone wanted to comment on it.
I think I've given it my best shot. I'm a big proponent of it. I think it's great. As I said earlier, when you get into the weeds, where the debate comes is, you know, exactly what spectrum do you want to make unlicensed? The farther up you go up the spectrum frequency chart, the less useful most people find the spectrum to be. The lower down you are, and particularly below 3 gigahertz, is where the propagation characteristics are such that it's really valuable. And so that's really where the rub is. I will note that two different FCC commissions under two different, under the Bush administration and under the Obama administration have said we need to do unlicensed in the TV bands. That's the bands that broadcasters currently use, and is very valuable stuff, very useful stuff. The commercial wireless broadband providers would like it more for themselves for very good reasons. But I think it's important that we preserve in the TV bands a certain amount, a balanced amount. I mean, we want to auction a bunch of that too. In the context of our proposal, we've actually said the first 84 megahertz of spectrum recovered from there would be auctioned, and it would be after that that the commission would have the authority to make some of it unlicensed. Although it wouldn't have to, we just want a balanced approach, and we do think it would be appropriate for the FCC to have that discretion.
Anybody else want to respond about that? No.
I think we all agree.
Well, let's thank our panelists.